Hippocrates said, let your medicine be your food, and let your food be your medicine. But Hippocrates was of yesterday, and yesterday is gone. Today we take pharmaceutical chemicals for medicine, but they lead us to ask, what separated our food from our medicine?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 621st edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Cooktown who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Hi.
Producer Carol Stafford is out and about. And there she is. Say hello.
Hello.
Producer Carol Parmalee Taff.
Hello.
And look at this, a studio guest. We have Rolf here. Say hello, Rolf.
Good morning.
All right, good. Folks, throughout history, people have followed the advice of Hippocrates and ate themselves to health with food, or at least they certainly tried. But somewhere in the not-too-distant past, people began substituting medicinal foods with pharmaceutical chemicals. These pharmaceuticals, for the most, act quickly to alleviate the symptoms of trouble, and so to heck with Hippocrates and those slow-acting foods. But wait, the best is yet to come. Pharmaceuticals may be protected with patents, whereas medicinal foods may not be protected. Consequently, a multi-billion dollar a year food chain grew around pharmaceuticals, and during the past decade alone, the pharmaceutical industry spent $1.5 billion lobbying the federal government to protect that food chain. Hey, that would give each senator $15 million were this money so invested. But in spite of all this protection, food as medicine appears to be making a comeback in the form of nutraceuticals and genetically modified organisms, or GMOs. These nutraceuticals are extracts of food claimed to have medicinal properties like garlic. These extracts are usually concentrated in capsules or solutions and then consumed as food. A GMO is a plant like rice that has the gene of a health-related element, like vitamin A, fused into its genes, and through the rice growth and development, it produces more vitamin A. And thus you get the magic of sight-saving golden rice. As new life, genetically modified organisms may be protected by patent, but as concentrated plant matter, nutraceuticals may not be patented. So we wonder, which will win your money? GMOs or nutraceuticals? Here to help us dig for an answer today on these questions and more, we have Nancy Chen, who is a medical anthropologist with the University of California and also the author of Food Medicine and the Quest for Good Health. Nihama.
Hi, good morning.
Welcome aboard. Pleased to have you here. Nancy, how did you become, what on earth is a medical anthropologist?
Well, that's a question my folks have asked for.
You're going to school to do what, they said?
Yes, exactly. Basically, a medical anthropologist is someone who really looks at medicine as a cultural system. So whether we're looking at medicine here in the West or medicine elsewhere, we really try to think about the relationship between culture and healing. And regardless of whether it's biomedicine or traditional medicine, any practice is deeply embedded in cultural beliefs.
And where did you start tuning into this as a person?
Well, as a person, I'd have to say growing up as a child, my mom was someone who did not just believe in biomedicine, but when she came over as an immigrant to this country, she brought along a lot of tinctures, a lot of herbal medicines, and, you know, just believed in very different systems of the body. And so that resulted in very different beliefs about illness and disease.
Mm-hmm. And so that made a big difference, didn't it, in how you look at food?
Absolutely. I think that one of the first things that my mom did, if we ever got sick as children, was to immediately change our diet. She really believed that, you know, illness was a sign of imbalance, and that dietary therapy was perhaps one of the easiest and probably the most approachable ways to resolve the problem.
All smart mothers do that, don't they?
Yeah, I very much believe that.
And how did she change her diet?
Well, I write in my book about rice porridge.
Rice porridge?
Yes.
Is that the Chinese equivalent of chicken soup?
Probably, yeah. Uh-huh. And what she often did was immediately restrict me from, you know, of course, sugary cereals and everything else. Mm-hmm. Would just, you know, have me on a very, very simple diet of rice porridge. So I knew that if I wanted to be well, I would have to, you know, make sure that I could prove to my mom I was well. And I knew that I was getting better when she would add, for instance, maybe a tiny pickle to the rice porridge. So she, you know, her form of dietary therapy was elimination and, you know, really strengthening the body with very simple food.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. And you did look at Chinese medicine and kind of went back in your book, Food Medicine and the Quest for Good Health. And, of course, we here in the West always look to China because perhaps China has, you know, a much greater experience in managing food as a medicine. But why would that be?
Well, I think what's fascinating is the story of the emperor. For instance, the highest paid employee in his court was not the, you know, say, general or scholar, but it was actually the nutritional therapist. This was considered to be the highest-ranking person of all, and it had to do with the fact that this person was in charge of what the emperor ate, and this person was paid to keep the emperor well, rather than you know, if the emperor got sick, then that of course was blamed on the nutritional therapist. So
short-term job, right?
Exactly. So yeah, that tells you a lot about. You know, the highest ranking person in the court is someone who's concerned about nutritional therapy. So this is and you see this transcended in Chinese medicine, where of course the first line of medicine is through diet and nutrition.
Mm-hmm. Tell us about Shen Neng.
Shen Neng is he's considered to be a mythical figure. He's considered to be the god of agriculture as well as the god of medicine. And he was someone who was basically...
the divine farmer.
That's right. Divine farmer. And this is a wonderful title because apparently he learned about healing herbs and plants and traditional medicines through his practices of observing animals. Some animals would fall ill and immediately... try to find a particular mm-hmm. plant or herb to munch on, and that's how he figured out the different traditional medicines.
Mm-hmm. You know, I found that kind of fascinating with respect to how you find out which herbs are good and which ones are bad.
Absolutely.
Because, of course, you get sick when you eat the bad ones. So how do you know not to eat the bad ones?
Well, I think, you know, Chinese medicine, as well as many traditional systems of medicine, are based on very long-standing practices.
So the first person that ate the bad herbs fell over dead, and everybody else said, bad stuff, stay away, right?
That's right. But Shen Nong himself also fell ill by the same practice. You know, he accidentally ate something that didn't agree with him and was severely ill. And he basically foraged about until apparently he found the right herb or plant to consume. Mm-hmm. So the same thing for him as well.
I had the opportunity to do some traveling in the headwaters of the Amazon with Shipibo Indians, and the Curandero for the tribe took us on a walk through the woods. And what I learned is that the Curanderos, or the witch doctors, I guess, if you may, learn about which plants are good and which ones are bad by talking to them through the vehicle of this tropical mixture of jungle juice called ayahuasca.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that they have a psychological breakthrough, if you will, but they claim to be actually able to talk to plants and thus determine which ones are good and which ones are bad. When we get back from the coming break, I'd like to ask Nancy Chen, author of Food, Medicine, and a Quest for Good Health, about the Taoist religion and what role food as medicine plays in religion. This is The Food Chain. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Today we do have Nancy Chen, who is a medical anthropologist for the University of California. And we're talking about food as medicine, the history of our taking food as medicine. And we're looking to figure out what happened to that relationship between food and medicine that seems to have disappeared in modern times. Now we eat food to grow, and we take medicine to get well. But that was not always the case. We will find out what changed that. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back out there. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, you know, many years ago, Hippocrates said, let medicine be your food and let your food be your medicine. And so it was forever until very recently when we discovered pharmaceutical chemicals. And those chemicals, we learned, could be developed that would really act quickly to alleviate the symptoms of what troubles us. And so to heck with Hippocrates. Now we take medicine to get well, and we eat food to grow up, I guess. But that was not always the case, and today we're talking about how food has been medicine through various cultures and various periods of time. And right now we're going to go back to early China and talk about the Taoist religion and what role food as medicine played in culture of that time. Nancy?
Hi, good morning.
So take us back to the Taoist, and what... what relationship did food and medicine have then?
Well, it's really interesting. I think that a lot of scholars might say that Taoism is less a religion and more so a philosophy and practice of spiritual beliefs. And what's fascinating about the Taoists is that they were very, very concerned about longevity.
Isn't that the aim of all medicine?
Yes. Absolutely. I think not just longevity, but, you know, well-being.
So well-being, yes.
One thing to live long, but another thing to live long and well. So the Taoists were folks who believed that what you consumed had a great impact on your body and your health. And so oftentimes they engaged in what has been referred to by scholars as Taoist alchemy.
And what could be more fun than Taoist alchemy?
Well, sometimes it could be quite deadly. I mean, they consume things like, you know, cinnabar or, you know, other heavy metals that
Ooh.
Ended up not necessarily being quite so longevity.
So when they went swimming, they sank, and that was the end of that, right?
Right. Or they basically had perished of mercury poisoning. So, so not everything they consumed was necessarily healthy for them. But nonetheless, what was instructive from Taoist philosophy and practices is the very notion of food as having particular energies and paying very close attention to the type of energies or different types of energies that different plants and food matter gave off. And so they were very concerned about grain, for instance. They believed that consuming too much grain was actually very heavy for the spirit for the body, and they were very concerned about meat as well. So so a lot of Taoist...
so those are the two things that our Western diet are pretty well based on, right? Grains and meats?
That's right. And so a lot of the Taoist dietary practices was actually a practice of abstinence, of really trying to restrict certain elements of food that were considered to be too heavy for the body, mm-hmm. really trying to consume foods that were more conducive to balance and enhancing the energy of the body.
Well, let's talk about some of the elements in the Chinese food as medicine diet. And I guess the obvious place to start would be the herbs, right?
Absolutely. And it's interesting, in this country we tend to think of herbs as either, you know, the herbs that we have in our little, by the kitchen that we throw in our, say, pasta or other foods. But, you know, in Chinese herbs are very much within the medicinal category. But they're also part of regular dishes in which we don't really think of them as herbs, but really part and central components of the dish.
Hmm. And some good examples. Probably everybody knows about ginseng, right?
That's right. Another food item that's really come on the market these days is the wolfberry. And I talk about this in my book. Mm-hmm. Wolfberries are considered to be a tonic for the kidneys. And they're basically little red berries that either can be consumed in a tea or often more frequently either combined with either rice porridge, sometimes meats as well, particularly if you want to restore or nourish the body. Meat is considered to be an important dish. It just depends on the timing and
sure.
Of, you know, the season.
Sure. And what exactly is the wolfberry? Does it have another name here?
Yes. I'm actually trying to look in my book right now.
I noticed you have a recipe for wolfberry soup.
That's right. And it's basically, there's a Latin name for it, and I mm-hmm. actually... I have to say,
well, is it
right
something
now.
That we can find here in the United States, or is it
yes,
endemic
yes.
to just China?
Yeah, I just found the name. It's Lycium barbarium, barbarum. And this is a berry now that has become packaged. It used to be you can only find it in, you know, Chinese herbal stores in Chinatown, but now it's become one of the health food ingredients where, you know, probably if you go to any of the health food stores in one's neighborhood, you'll be able to find that.
Well, good. Producer Carol Stafford wants to know about goji.
Goji berries.
Goji
yes.
berries.
It's basically the same thing.
Same thing as wolfberry.
That's right.
Okay, good. And then, of course, we are always aware, when we think about Chinese food, that they have some pretty interesting uses for animals.
Yes, yes. That's also one of the controversies. I think that in the past, you know, the more exotic or the more unusual the animal, the very different energies and powers associated with that. And so the belief was that by consuming a component of that animal, one would, you know, by consumption, you know, take on the energies of that. So therefore, you know, for instance, bear paws were considered mm-hmm. to be, you know, powerful and heat and warm. You know, dog flesh or, you know, deer antler. These are items that are used in traditional Chinese medicine. But these days, it's become more and more frequent that these animals are either hunted down or, you know, that their consumption is harvested. The harvest of these animals is in very unethical ways. So there's a huge controversy about that.
Well, let me ask you this. I guess this is a good point to kind of make that bridge between foods and pharmaceuticals. With respect to consuming animals to increase one's potency, do you think that the development of Viagra and its sister drugs has had an impact on the wildlife population of places like China?
Well, they actually, there's been a couple of media articles that do address that, and they say that it has, to some extent, alleviated this, but mm-hmm. It has not wiped out the very firm belief that certain animals will have particular energies and powers, and that the consumption of these particular animals or body parts is still very significant. So, yes, certainly the production of certain pharmaceuticals might alleviate, say, in the urban areas, perhaps less consumption of particular exotic animals. But but it hasn't completely transformed that practice.
Mm-hmm. Well, you talked about humors, and you did so without laughing. So what did you mean by humors?
Well, humors are the humoral system of medicine in the body is something that was really not just in traditional cultures, but even in the medieval period in Europe, there was a very strong belief in the humors. People were characterized or put in categories of the humors. So if you were, I believe, acerbic, you were considered to be, you know, a certain quality. This is where, you know, if you read, you know, Chaucer's tales or...
Mm-hmm. Canterbury Tales.
Canterbury Tales. They had very specific descriptions of people according to their humors. And so in my book, I talk about the fact that humoral medicine is something that's shared in many traditional systems of healing. And what's interesting is that somehow we've kind of moved away from that. But if you, for instance, practice Ayurvedic medicine, for instance, one, you're, you know, categorized according to Pitta, Kapha, and a third category. And basically, these are the humors.
Mm-hmm.
And Chinese medicine, too, you're categorized according to what is your basic humor. And foods, as well, have humors. And so in order to balance yourself, you must consume particular foods that would have certain qualities.
Wow, so they would meld your personality or at least modify it? Or
that's right. They would modify, you know, say, for instance, if you're ill and it turns out that your liver, I'm thinking in terms of Chinese.
Got to hold that. We're going to have to take a quick break. Nancy Chen, right back. Do stay tuned. Well, what do you think? Can eating the right food create the right mood? Let's ask Dr. Nancy Chen, who is a medical anthropologist with the University of California and also author of Food Medicine and the Quest for Good Health. We're talking a little bit about the relationship of food and medicine and how at one time food was the medicine, but how that relationship has been severed. And now we take medicine to get well and we eat food to get through the day, I guess. And we're talking about the loss of humors. And humors are not which makes us laugh, but how would you define humors again, Nancy Chen?
Well, humors are basically properties of heat, cold, moisture, and dryness. These are ways in which bodies, as well as plants and food, become categorized in a system of belief about healing and medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a system of belief that was very common, not just in across Asia, but also in Europe as well.
And it's something we've kind of given up and is lost now, correct?
Yes.
Hmm. Another one of those things that bites the dust. Let's talk a little bit about food as medicine here in the United States. And perhaps by doing so, we can see the evolution from food to pharmaceuticals as our medicine. Let's start with, I guess, let's start with the patent medicines that used to be peddled from the back of wagons in Western towns. What were they?
Well, they were primarily alcohol.
That always works, right?
Yeah, right. This was, you know, of course, one theory by a scholar has been that, you know, during the Prohibition period that, you know, patent medicines were the primary form by which alcohol could be legally consumed.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, even prior to Prohibition, patent medicines during the 19th century was very prominent. And part of it had to do with what's fascinating about this emergence of patent medicines was that it was also responsible for the emergence of the FDA, the Food and Drug Administration.
Right.
But during the 19th century, patent medicines flourished. There was no regulation about actual potency or effectiveness, mm-hmm, of these patent medicines. So this was also the period when, you know, advertisements for medicines really began.
Right, and making exorbitant claims. You know, I heard an interesting story once when I was visiting Dr. Barry Sears in Boston, and Dr. Sears talked about how those people who sold patent medicines from the back of wagons and stuff became known as snake oil salesmen. and kind of a derogatory term. But it turns out that snake oil came from the Chinese who came to the United States to work on the railroads. And they brought with them the oil of the sea snake, which was extremely rich in long-chain omega-3 fatty acids, which was something that was very much used in there as a healing medicine at the time. So I kind of find that fascinating that that the derogatory term snake oil actually turned out to be something of very real substance. Have you ever heard of that?
Well, I'm trying to think of, I haven't heard of sea snakes, but I'm thinking about sea cucumbers, which is an ingredient that one would only see, for instance, at a Chinese banquet, considered to be a very rare exotic dish that is considered to be, you know, good for you. So it's not something you would find on everyday tables at home, but definitely something at a banquet, for instance. The other ingredient related to snakes that you might see is in cough medicine. There's it's not so much snake oil, but apparently snake gall or snake, and this ingredient is supposed to help alleviate coughing. So you might still find this in, for instance, Chinese medicine, the little tubes that have liquids that you break open and you're supposed to sip through a straw.
Huh. Okay, let's go back to the United States here and talk about the evolution of soft drinks and how essentially they began as medicine, correct?
That's right. Well, this is a very fun fact that I discovered when I was teaching my course on food. You know, I write about beverages, and soft drinks we tend to, you know, just think of as, you know, any type of carbonated water with, you know, flavoring. But it actually goes back to the soda fountain. And actually, soda fountains were tied to early pharmacies because the early history of prior to soda drinks was the fact that people used to consume mineral water. This was a very common event in Europe and still happens today. People would take the waters in which they would go to the sources of where mineral baths were and drink the waters.
Because we like the bubbles?
Yes. And then later, as the it became possible, an inventor discovered how to carbonate water to basic mineral waters. And so they ended up, you know, creating, it became commercially available so that one could have carbonated waters, not just at the sites where mineral baths were, but also at the pharmacies.
Mm-hmm.
So gradually, different pharmacies decided that they would try to bring, you know, some customers in by creating different flavors. You know, so this is where sarsaparilla or root beer, many different types of soft drinks or soda drinks were created.
And largely starting from those medicinal herbs, right?
That's right. That's
root beer and sarsaparilla?
That's right.
Mm-hmm. And what happened to that industry?
Well, as we know, that's become a multi-million dollar, you know, soft drink industry as a result. You know, very quickly, bottling became possible during the late 19th, early 20th century. And so, you know, as soft drinks became bottled, you know, with the automobile industry, as people traveled, they realized quickly that, you know, not just going to one's local pharmacy, but also being able to go to, say, or a soda fountain nearby in town, but on the road, being able to, you know, drink soft drinks on the road was considered to be a restorative, but also a moneymaker. So that's how our soft drink industry has, you know, what at least one historical root of our soft drink industry today.
Mm-hmm. And there it is. And, of course, it seems to be heading back that direction, does it not?
That's right. What's fascinating is if you go to, you know, a lot of the shelves where, you know, bottled soft drinks are, there are a lot more brands and labels that actually harken back to that early period. So, you know, you might find a couple of new brands that, you know, might sound as if they're medicinal.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, what about the energy drinks?
Energy drinks are a great example as well. This is really, you know, one of the new, so-called new areas where, you know, they believe that it ties to the youth market. But in fact, energy drinks are very much a tie to the past. And a lot of energy drinks are actually based on drinks that already exist in Latin America as well as Asia, where they are taking drinks that have been consumed for quite some time there and basically repackaging it for the Western markets here.
Okay, folks, you're tuned into The Food Chain. Michael Olson, your host for the day. Today we're talking with Nancy Chen, a medical anthropologist for the University of California and also author of Food, Medicine, and the Quest for Good Health. We're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk with Nancy about how our food became separated from our medicine, what happened there, and what the prospects are for the future of our food as medicine. If you have any questions, we'd love to hear from them from you. Our phone numbers today, 800-624-2665 and 831-479-1080. Right back. Hippocrates said, let your food be your medicine and your medicine be your food. And so forever, that was the case until fairly recently, and it was no longer the case because we found pharmaceuticals that could act much quicker and alleviate pain and alleviate symptoms. So we lost that connection, or seem to have lost that connection, between food as medicine. And I guess one of the things that we were talking about here in the studio during the break was what happened when we took sugar and put it with our foods that we used as medicine, the soft drinks, the bubbling waters and whatnot, because we were talking about how the Coca-Cola company just purchased the vitamin water company for billions of dollars, and of course now the vitamin water has 13 grams of sugar in it. So let's ask Nancy Chen, who is a medical anthropologist and author of Food, Medicine, and the Quest for Good Food. Nancy, what happened when we added sugar to our foods that we used as medicine?
Well, it's interesting. There are two ways of thinking about sugar. One that has I've been learned from my colleagues who are physical anthropologists, there's an innate desire for sugar. We, as primates, crave sweet, and you actually, my colleague Nate Dominey, who actually Professor Dominey, who studies primates in Africa, he's observed primates that will, you know, go much further to find fruit that is sweeter or slightly fermented as a result. There's an innate craving for sugar, but then sugar for the long time was considered to be very, very valuable. It was considered to be medicinal. It was used as a preservative. And so the adding of sugar to either, say, drinks or to foods was something that was considered to be a way in which one literally added value.
Mm-hmm.
In the contemporary moment, our sugary drinks is really considered to be, there's still a certain belief that, you know, sugar also adds not just calories, but, you know, quite literally energy. So that's perhaps one of the reasons why, you know, sugar continues on today. What I found very interesting was actually the acquisition of stevia, which is a very, very sweet substance. It's a plant that is considered to be probably 100 times sweeter than sugar. And so a lot of the soft drink industry companies have decided to produce more drinks using stevia.
It has no calories, right?
Right. It has no calories, and so therefore there are, and also there's belief that it will, you know, produce less cavities as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the question of the day: is what on earth happened that we lost food as a medicine, in your estimation?
Well, I think in my book I talk about the notion of nutritional illiteracy, that somehow we have forgotten, even though on the one hand we seem to be a diet-obsessed culture and society.
Boy, do we ever.
Absolutely. Where, you know, literally almost every month there's a new diet or a new, more effective diet to lose weight. But ironically, we've really lost touch with nutrition. And part of this has to do with education, that, you know, in schools, even medical schools, for instance, nutrition is not considered to be a basic fundamental science that should be taught to either healers or to children.
So they don't teach nutrition in medical schools?
It's not a required course.
Wow.
This is, given the amount of courses that, medical students have to take, nutrition is usually not one of the required courses.
So maybe doctors get one elective course in nutrition?
If at all.
And so when you say illiteracy, you're not just talking about we the people, you're talking about the medical establishment.
About the medical establishment, but we as a society as well have really lost touch with nutritional knowledge and nutritional therapy.
And those were that was the knowledge that your mother carried from her mother.
Absolutely.
And my mother carried from her mother.
That's right. And very simply, in the types of foods that she made, in the types of foods that she specifically would make in times of illness. And I believe that, in this moment where we're time-starved as well as, starved for nutritional knowledge, I think that most of
So here, kid, take this pill and leave me alone because I've got to go to work.
That's right. Right.
And thus we lose the knowledge and thus we become dependent on pharmaceuticals. Now, in my introduction, I talked about how pharmaceuticals may be patented, but foods that we use as medicines may not be patented. Does that have a role to play in why we've lost foods as a medicine?
No, I do believe that in many parts of the world, not necessarily in this country, but in other parts of the world, food is still considered to be a very central component.
Places that don't have a lot of money, maybe?
That's right. And also even here. We have a lot of immigrant communities that still very much, practice nutritional therapy as a front line of preventative medicine.
But for those of us who have a lot of money, we seem to lost track of food as medicine then.
Right.
Because it's easier to rely on the patent medicines, the pharmaceuticals, the cure in a bottle.
Right. And also, I think within biomedicine, there is this belief that, pharmaceuticals are the most, fast and effective. That's what we're led to believe. Healing with nutritional therapy takes a long time. It's not something that can, change things right away.
And time is money.
That's right.
So get out of my way, Hippocrates. Folks, this is The Food Chain. We're talking with Nancy Chen, medical anthropologist, University of California, and author of Food, Medicine, and the Quest for Good Health. Right back. Where do we go from here? Do stay tuned. Well, where do we go from here? It appears to be food is coming back as medicine. It's coming back as two different kinds of forms. One is a nutraceutical, and the other is as the genetically modified organism. Nancy Chen, a medical anthropologist for the University of California and also author of Food, Medicine, and the Quest for Good Health. What do you see in the future for nutraceuticals and GMOs? And perhaps we ought to start with a little definition of what the heck is a nutraceutical?
Well, a nutraceutical has sometimes been called as functional food. And I talk about the fact that, this is a neologism or a new term. Basically, Stephen DeFelice coined this term in 1979 to mean basically any food item that has a health benefit. Since then, the food industry has really evolved since then. So these are compounds that are sometimes naturally derived. They're considered to be bioactive and considered to either have health promotion or medicinal properties. And then what happens is that these foods become bioengineered, or in other words, produced. So, for instance, lycopene, which is considered to be
the good stuff in tomatoes.
That's right. It's considered to be, something that might prevent heart disease or treat cancer. And so, you know, for instance, you know, you might find tomato juice that has enhanced lycopene or other types of compounds. But there's a lot of controversy about, you know, nutraceuticals because it's not regulated. And there are certain claims.
So like the days of the patent medicine salesman, people can say kind of what they want, but there is some rules that are called the SHE.
That's right, right. And the SHE is, you know, an act that was really trying to, it's the...
Trying to put form to the craziness.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Let's talk quickly, genetically modified organisms. What future do you see there?
Well, there's some pretty interesting ones. I mean, in Australia, for instance, they're planting, you know, spinach with antibiotics. So, for instance, this is an enhanced form of, you know, spinach, which is good for you, but then also, you know, instead of taking a pill, it'll be in your food.
That's
well.
The brave new world of food is medicine, right?
That's right.
Nancy Chin, we want to thank you for joining us. Nancy is the medical anthropologist, University of California, also author of Food Medicine and A Quest for Good Health, a fun read. Pick it up and enjoy a look at food as medicine. This has been The Food Chain. We thank you all out there for tuning in, and we look forward to you joining us on the forums at metrofarm.com. Until next week, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.